You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Joel Greenberg, author of A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. You mentioned Charles Otis Whitman. He was the founder of the Marine Biological Laboratory here in Woods Hole, its first director. One of his first loves was the passenger pigeon, and he had a flock of his own, which would accompany him each summer when he came to Woods Hole from Chicago. One of the birds in his flock was Martha, the last passenger pigeon who we mentioned died 100 years ago at the Cincinnati Zoo. Tell us more about Whitman and his interest in the passenger pigeon.
Sure. Whitman was an interesting guy. He didn't publish much, but he was at Clark University for a long time, and then University of Chicago bought him away from Clark. He was interested in bird behavior, and so he had numerous species of pigeons. And he said he liked passenger pigeons. They were among the favorites. And his flock was the only flock ever studied by scientists. But again, you know, it was in a narrow confines of a cage. But despite that, and it's sort of interesting, and historians have written about it, he and other scientists of the day really weren't that interested in conservation. Virtually all the photos you see of live passenger pigeons were from his flock. Yet, he never wrote about the need to preserve them. He did breed them, but not for the purpose that we might think of today.
Hmm.
Another interesting aspect is there were three captive flocks. One originated from a single pair of birds, and that was owned by Whitaker in Milwaukee. And at some point, Whitman obtained Whitaker's flock, and that's where Martha came from. And then, of course, he sent Martha to the third captive flock, which was Cincinnati. And so gradually over the years, you know, each of those the birds died out, they were inbred, it was impossible to get wild birds. But there never was this idea of really mixing them or really trying to carry them on. So even at the end, there wasn't really anything like a conservation effort that you might see today.
So what is the legacy of Martha?
Well, to me, there's hundreds of place names named after passenger pigeons. The story still inspires people, and since 2010, there have been at least four novels written where the pigeon is a major element of the plot or as a setting. But to me, the great legacy really is one of conservation. So, as a cautionary tale to the proposition that no matter how common something is, no matter how abundant it is, could be water, could be fuel, could be something alive, if we're not good stewards, we can lose it.
Mm.
We need to be vigilant because sometimes these depletions occur in a very rapid amount. And there's 7 billion of us at this point. And so we need to be circumspect with how we use the planet's resources if we want it to remain beautiful and rich.
And of course, the impacts of that. So, you know, difficult to know exactly how the extinction of the passenger pigeon impacted the ecology of the natural world. But some theorize Lyme disease might not be as rampant today if the passenger pigeon had survived. Explain that.
Sure. The bacteria that creates Lyme disease is found in mice, Paramyscus, white-footed mice, which feed on acorns and other mast. So the idea is that when the pigeons were around competing for this food source, it kept the mice, the mouse population low, and thus there never was the opportunity for the disease to spread as widely as it has. There are other diseases, as encephalitis, where there were outbreaks in Massachusetts and New Jersey in the early 20th century, and there's a notion that, and it's birds that are the reservoir of that disease, and they felt that more sedentary birds would be more likely to hold the disease and more likely to create an outbreak than, you know, if passenger pigeons were around, which were constantly moving and would be less exposed to the mosquitoes that carried the disease.
You mentioned the hawks that fed on the pigeons. Do we know how that impacted? I mean, was that their preferred food? Do we know that? I mean, and how that might have impacted their numbers once they were extinct?
Well, there have been the two big exhibitors. The goshawk is the largest, and back in the mid 1800s, goshawks summer as far south as southern Wisconsin. I think they were in Pennsylvania. And nobody's, there's no data really, but the passenger pigeons disappeared and the goshawks retreated farther north. The next size down exhibitor is the Cooper's hawk, which has now in the last few years become quite abundant in backyards throughout America. But people at the time thought that as the pigeons decreased, so did the Cooper's hawk. So those would be two examples. Mm-hmm. There's an insect called the American bearing beetle that used to be from Oklahoma to the Atlantic, and now, you know, it's down to a Block Island and I think one other island.
Yeah, and they're doing some, trying to do some research in Nantucket.
Exactly.
It's a fascinating story.
Yeah. To other places. And one idea is there's a certain, so bearing beetles require a carcass and they, you know, lay their eggs in it and the larvae feed on it. And so they've determined the ideal size of the carcass. And so looking back, trying to figure out how this insect population collapsed like it did, the passenger pigeon and greater prairie chicken were of the right size for them, and it's been, it's pure conjecture. I mean, most all of this is, but it's been suggested that the loss of those larger birds, those particular ones, might have had an impact on the decline of the bearing beetle.
So could we bring the passenger pigeon back using DNA samples of specimens we still have?
Well, that's certainly kind of a $1,000 question. I was fortunate to be invited to the first meeting that the Long Now Foundation held, and that was at the Harvard Medical School. And I guess what I think about it is there are some really smart people who are working on it. I know the guy, Ben Novak, who's been tasked with leading the effort. He believes that through genetic manipulation that can be done. And then, they know about this, but even if you were to somehow create something that you could say was a passenger pigeon, there's all kinds of social and political issues. So more mourning doves are shot as a game bird than any other bird in the United States. And so if you created a flock of passenger pigeons, and if you allowed them to fly around like they used to, they would almost certainly be shot during mourning dove season because they look so much like them. You would have to create a flock that didn't migrate. So there's just, you know, lots of different. And the other point, too, is you're never going to recreate hundreds of millions of birds, which is certainly part of the mystique of the species.
Yeah. Tell us about Project Passenger Pigeon.
Well, as I started research on my book in August of 2009, I learned that some other people, particularly David Blockstein, who's an ornithologist in Washington, D.C., were also thinking about the anniversary, about 2014. And so I talked to him, and I started my, what I call evangelizing. I went to the Cincinnati Zoo and talked to people there. They were very excited about it. Here in Chicago, the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum, they were very excited. And so there was a meeting in 2011, and we brought people from all over, from the Smithsonian, Neely Bruce, a musicologist from Wesleyan University in Connecticut. And out of that emerged Project Passenger Pigeon. And the goal of it is to tell people the story of the pigeon and then to highlight the messages that story holds for us today. And so we've been doing that. I mean, I've been doing that. There's a website where I've got a documentary that I'm co-producing with a talented film director, David Mrazek. That's going to be available in March, probably. We're hoping it will be aired widely on public television. So there's just a whole hundreds of programs and exhibits. I think we have about 160 organizations involved. I'm going to be speaking at two venues in Massachusetts, and then during the summer at the Plymouth Plantation. So I'll be in Massachusetts twice this year.
Well, I hope you'll stop by when you're here. You do. You have an interactive map on the Project Passenger Pigeon website that gives information about the history in particular regions. Surprised to read that one of the last reported sightings of a passenger pigeon in Massachusetts was in Woods Hole in the 1890s, perhaps one of an escaped pigeon from Mr. Whitman?
Well, Whitman lost. I mean, even though, you know, these birds were almost gone, and he had them. One or two birds did escape that one summer. So indeed, it might have been one of those birds.
Yeah. So throughout the 19th and 20th century, forest lands that we were mentioning, the habitat for these birds were cleared. Do you think the passenger pigeon would have been doomed even without the mass hunting due to habitat loss?
Well, I think that it certainly would have impacted their population in a way that it didn't, because the birds disappeared earlier. So I think that's a very good possibility. There still is a question in my mind whether they did eat other things besides acorns and beech nuts during the year. Could they have survived with feeding on fruit or other available food? It might not have been as nutritious. They may not have reproduced as well. But it seems to me not impossible that they could have. And also with the point of numbers, the birds, there were birds throughout their range that nested by the pairs and by the tens and by the hundreds. We really only know anything about these mass nestings. So what nobody ever bothered to sit and observe was whether a pair of birds in your back, your lower back 40 in the woods produced young. We do know that one of the last passenger pigeons shot in the wild, the famous Buttons, shot in Ohio in 1900, was a young bird. She was born in the spring of 1899 when there were virtually none left. So at least in that instance, a pair was able to fledge a young. Now, could they have survived at much lower numbers, especially with protection? I think it's possible, and that's one of those questions about this bird that we'll probably never know for sure.
Also, it was interesting, some of the research that's been done on looking back to the diets of the Native Americans and how much of these birds they consumed, because you do find other animal bones, but then you point out that these are birds, their bones, they might not have lasted. Talk a little bit about what we know about the Native Americans and the passenger pigeons.
Sure. Because the birds did move around like they did, and they couldn't be expected to nest in the same place year after year, I think there were relatively few groups of Indians that relied on them. The group, the Seneca Nation, their relationship with the passenger pigeon is better documented than any other. There were interviews in the early 20th century with Seneca who remembered the hunts, and it was a big deal. And you learn things like when they learned of the location, big groups of Seneca would load up. Poor people would just put barrels around their neck and hike, and the wealthier people had wagons, and some took horses. So in part, a lot of the consumption were in these temporary camps where the birds were. So that would further limit the possibility that you would find lots of remains. So the birds, for the Seneca and other groups as well, they incorporated them into their dance. They incorporated them into their culture, and so it was an important aspect to some of these groups. The Potawatomi, Simon Pokagon, he wrote some of the most remarkable prose descriptions of the bird that anyone ever did. He knew the birds well from living in the field and hunting them. So they're definitely was a relationship. It's pretty clear that the native peoples, for a bunch of reasons, the people of eastern United States relied on white-tailed deer and turkey as their principal food source, and the pigeon wasn't a major source, but seasonally, and if they appeared, they could help them for some limited amount of time.
Yeah, of course, the one pigeon they would not take would be that albino pigeon. They had great reverence for them.
Exactly, and in fact, there's a town in Michigan and another one in Indiana called White Pigeon, and it's named for a Potawatomi chief, but he in turn obviously was named for these sacred white albino passenger pigeons.
Yeah. So in all the research you did for the book, what was your biggest surprise?
Well, maybe just how relentless the slaughter was. The fact that Now, there really wasn't any conservation effort, and as I mentioned before, how some of the language used as the species started dwindling really does sound reminiscent of things people say today about climate or about fuel supplies, and so I guess some of the similarities in that respect. You know, I was able to find some records that of late birds that people hadn't known before. The other thing is how many. So the bird itself and its story is to me just really, you know, obviously fascinating. But there were some amazing characters that I encountered who were part of the archives of the pigeon. Junius Brutus Booth, John Wilkes' father, was a great actor, and he believed strongly that we should not kill other things. And he actually wanted to hold a funeral for passenger pigeons in 1830 to protest the killing of them. So that was kind of surprising as well, just, you know, that there were these handful of people, nothing close to something organized and not terribly effective, but still, you know, and even there are always some people who have this unique perspective, sometimes good, sometimes bad, that was something else that I found.
Well, it's certainly a fascinating story. A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. Joel Greenberg, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being on.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.